The metaverse is emerging as the next big technology platform and promises to be the next frontier for human experiences on the internet. Into the Metaverse covers companies, technologies, and trends that are bringing these promises to life. Join creator and host Jonathan Ross Friedman, founder and CEO of Supersocial, as he interviews the brilliant minds that are building, shaping, and investing in the Metaverse.
Welcome to another episode of Into the Metaverse, episode 93. I'm here, it's Matthew. I'm here to break down four news items from the past week or so that we think are influential to the development of the Metaverse. We'll provide our insights and analysis of those items, given, you know, the unique expertise that we possess. And as always, if there's any topics you'd like us to consider for future episodes, including short news items or topics you'd like us to do a deeper dive on, please let us know. And on our Substack page, we put out a survey recently. We'd love to hear from you, you know, more in depth, what you like about Into the Metaverse, what you'd like to hear more of. So please check that out and fill that out for us. Today's first topic, diving right into the platform that Supersocial, our company, builds on, Roblox. Roblox reported earnings results on May 9th, so about a week ago at this point, and its shares fell 22% the day of the earnings release. From a financial perspective, the numbers were disappointing, and the stock reacted, you know, in line with that. There were some positives and just some other points that I want to call out in terms of, you know, what does this mean not just for the financials and the stock, but what does it mean for brands and IP owners investing in the platform as well? You know, so although the Q1 operating financial metrics were largely in line with market expectations, there was a weaker second quarter outlook provided by Roblox, weaker versus, you know, the consensus estimates, and also the reduced guidance for the full year 2024, as well as like overall some deceleration in the growth rates and select KPIs that posed a tough pill to swallow. Some of the key metrics in the first quarter, daily active users reached a new record of 77.7 million that actually beat consensus of 76.8 million. ARPDAU, that's revenue per daily active user on a quarterly basis, was much weaker than expected, coming in at 1163 versus consensus 1209. And that was kind of the big sticking point, is the weaker monetization, which tied into the guidance I'll get to in a second. But notably, adjusted EBITDA actually beat expectations, even as bookings came in a bit light and ARPDAU came in a bit light, showing that Roblox has actually been doing a good job of managing costs, although there's been, you know, a slip up on the execution on the top line. For the guidance, they see second quarter bookings at 885 million. Consensus was 934.1 million. So that's a big miss. And then for 2024, they cut their guidance to 4.05 billion from 4.21 billion given just 3 months ago. I'll talk about the financials and kind of how the stock market perceives this first, but then I'll get into more, you know, what this means for brands and IP owners as well. From a stock market and investment perspective, it's a tough pill to swallow, as I said. And I think the overarching theme here, and we're going to publish this, we published this in a blog post as well, we talked about credibility and management credibility. And it's the fact that Roblox, for the first time in the results given at the end of the fiscal year 2023, which were released in February, that was the first time they gave formal guidance. And, you know, in my past working as an investment analyst, you know, interacting with investment professionals all day, one of the things that comes up in a lot of conversations is management credibility. When people think about investment quality and the ability for companies to meet or exceed targets that they set for the market. The fact that Roblox is cutting its full year guidance 3 months after the first time they ever gave guidance, that's a big hit to credibility. You know, you do not want to see that. In many cases, companies will, you know, give conservative is the term used, or some people say they sandbag their guidance, but they put out numbers that they think they can at least meet or even beat with a good degree of visibility, so that way they can level set expectations in the market. And, you know, I think this is, you know, partially a learning curve for Roblox as a public company, you know, setting targets and having to meet them, but also, you know, it's a learning curve for investors to understand that this is still a platform that's very early in its development, and you know, it's going to be a turbulent path to the end state of what we all think Roblox can be. For brands and IP owners that are investing in the platform, building experiences to engage natively with these digital natives, not much has changed because of this. You know, if you're a CMO and you look at, you know, your brand is investing on Roblox and you see the stock down 22% for Roblox, you know, you might be concerned about the health of the business by seeing that. But I don't think what anything that came through in the report should worry you. You know, again, we're still seeing DAU increase, but I think the fact that the DAU growth and the hours engaged growth and the bookings growth fell below those kind of soft targets of 20%, at least 20% per year, is mildly concerning. But it seems like that there's efforts in place to kind of, you know, accelerate those growth rates throughout the year. So we'll see if they can kind of hit those soft targets. But, you know, in terms of if you're investing in the platform, there's now almost 80 million daily active users. Increasingly so, they're over 13. So it's a slightly increasingly older demographic, and they're highly engaged. They're still spending 2.4, 2.5 hours per day on the platform. You know, obviously that's spread across a multitude of experiences. There's no experience where users spend that much time per day in them, but they jump between experiences, which is great if you're trying to build, you know, sustainable, long-lasting interactions where you can continue to bring people back to your experience. So that's a long-winded way to say that from an investment perspective, yes, it's a disappointing report, and it might take a couple quarters for Roblox to win back, you know, kind of investor sentiment and investor trust. They really need to execute and deliver, and probably meeting targets at this stage isn't necessarily good enough. They might have to beat, but, you know, in terms of brands and IP owners investing, again, I don't think much has changed, at least from this report specifically. Moving on to the next item today, we're actually going to go through all three major console makers to wrap up today's episode. The first is looking at Xbox and, you know, diving into some of the layoffs and studio closures they announced recently, and just kind of the uncertainty around the Xbox strategy at this point. So after spending $69 billion to acquire Activision Blizzard, largest acquisition in gaming history, Microsoft is actually cutting by shutting down a handful of studios, including a few that were acquired from Bethesda. What's notable here is more the why than the what, though, as I was alluding to. So Microsoft is closing down studios that publish popular games such as Hi-Fi Rush, the types of smaller scale games it says it wants more of, but then at the same time, they're also signaling potentially that they want to kind of go down the proven strategy of fewer, bigger, better games. And so it's really kind of confusing as to what the strategy is at Xbox, right? On the one hand, you have a subscription service where you're going to need a constant flow of content. And honestly, like smaller games that are consumable, you know, if we're thinking like double A quality or even A quality games that are consumable in call 10 to 20 hours that don't cost nine figures to produce and market, those are the type of games that can theoretically be successful inside of a subscription where you have, you know, 30 million or so subscribers at this point. Going down the bigger, better, best route, which is proven for AAA developers like Activision, who they just bought, right? That was a big strategy shift from Activision over the last decade, was releasing fewer games, releasing, you know, larger, bigger games, and focusing on only the most profitable. There's definitely value in doing that, but it's kind of at odds of what's needed to drive interest in Game Pass. So, you know, for a long time, I've said on this podcast and others that Xbox is the Game Pass company and they're all in on Game Pass. But some of these moves do raise questions as to what the future of Xbox is and how they plan for the future, right? Do they want to go down the strategy of fewer, bigger, better? Or do they want to have more of these smaller scale games that are better suited to the subscription model? I think there's personally has to be a balance of both. I don't think it's a either or necessarily, but, you know, when you see them shutting down some of these relatively successful studios, I know Redfall, the studio behind Redfall was one of them that got shut down and they had some quality issues on the release, but, you know, Hi-Fi Rush was well received by a lot of people. To see that studio shut down, I mean, I'm sure there'll be more postmortems over the months ahead that kind of dive into the why, but it is kind of interesting to see that these moves are being made while they're saying this is the type of content they need. And so it'll be interesting to see what Xbox, what Microsoft says and how they think about the future of their business, especially as we also consider, you know, the future of hardware as well, right? We're increasingly getting to a point where hardware is less relevant. You know, there's games available on all platforms. Game Pass is available on more platforms. Microsoft is putting more of its games on PlayStation and other platforms. And so a lot of these questions are all kind of have to come to fruition and deserve answers in the near future. And so we'll see where they shake out. Moving on to Sony, they actually reported financial results this week. And, you know, they were overall, the financial results were fairly good, though they did miss on PlayStation units sold, which I think is a broader macroeconomic story in the sense that people are deferring purchases of expensive goods globally, not just in the US, and that's why they kind of came under. But they actually beat on profitability because of strong game sales and especially, you know, in-game monetization and existing games, right? So I think there's continuing to be the trend there that, and you saw this with Microsoft as well to a degree in their results, that there continues to be a trend of people continue to spend and play in the games that they most engage in, but they're being more selective where they engage and where they spend the money, and they're deferring these large purchases like upfront console purchases. But what I wanted to get into today was the backlash that occurred around Helldivers 2. And for those that don't know, Helldivers 2 is like a co-op shooter game. They released it both on PlayStation and on PC. And when they first released it on Steam, it was available as long as you had Steam. You could buy it anywhere. And then recently, before walking back on this and not actually ending up doing it, Sony got into hot water because they wanted to retroactively basically make Steam players register with a PSN account so that way they could play a game they already paid for. Some commentators on the internet were kind of like, well, other console makers and other companies that publish on Steam make you sign up for their account. For example, Take-Two does that with, you know, you have to have a Rockstar account to play GTA. But the difference is that they did that before selling the game. So you knew that you had to have a Rockstar account before buying it. In this case, there are countries where PSN is not available. And so you could have bought Helldivers 2 on Steam, and then a few weeks, months later, whatever it may be, they come out and tell you, actually, now you can't play it because we don't have our service in your country, and we're going to make everyone who to play this game, you have to sign up for the service. And so this caused a lot of negative sentiment in the community and a lot of downvoting of the game on Steam in just a couple of days. As I mentioned, Sony eventually backed off on this and didn't enforce it, but the damage is done. And, you know, yes, there's some natural decline in CCUs for every game after it hits that initial launch peak, but it's clear that there's a downtrend in the CCUs that's been ongoing. It's hard to say necessarily that this is a cause or at least an acceleration of it, but I don't think, you know, sentiment like this helps a game. And overall, this is a lesson in community building, which is a big part of, you know, building an audience of digital natives, right? This is a great case study of, you know, how brands, IP owners, corporations need to think about engaging with digital natives. You know, there's the right way to do things and there's the wrong way to do things. And even though in theory, it's a good idea to have all of your players inside of one account, the way you execute, message, and implement it is really important. And so as we think about, you know, as we build communities on Roblox with brands and IP, there's really important takeaways here in the sense of being really cognizant of building with a community first mentality and understanding the wants, needs, and desires of the community that you're interacting with and including them in the decision-making process where it makes sense. And so, you know, overall, I think that there's a lot of lessons to be learned here in terms of the right way to build and manage communities and digital platforms. And then lastly, moving on to Nintendo, you know, they came out and confirmed that the sequel to the Switch is coming, just not yet. With their latest financial results, they confirmed that a sequel to the Switch, which, by the way, is the most successful console they've ever released, the sequel is coming, just not in the fiscal year ending March of 2025. They said it'll likely be the next fiscal year. You know, speculation as to when that might be, but given, you know, the original Switch launched in March, so it was right at the tail end of a fiscal year for Nintendo. Given that they're saying it won't hit the fiscal year 2025, and it'll be sometime in the fiscal year 26, it could point to a holiday 2025 release, so the fourth quarter of 2025, or if they hit that March deadline, then it would be March of 2026. So that's kind of the timeline that we're looking at. And, you know, this also comes at a time, you know, similar to Sony, that they're forecasting a down year for hardware revenue, which again makes sense not only with the macro conditions, but just the fact that the Switch is in that mature and end of the cycle where it's been so successful. It sold so many units through. There was definitely a COVID bump for sure in there as well, you know, and obviously it's going to slow organically. And now that you're telegraphing that, yes, the new platform is coming, there probably will be a further deceleration in unit sales. And so I think that you definitely noted that in the results. You know, I think as we think about what they need to do differently with the sequel to the Switch versus what they've done with the Switch so successfully is, you know, number one, I think it needs to be iterative and not a full new replacement. You know, in the past, there was a lack of backwards compatibility between for example, the Wii U and the Wii, or the Switch and the Wii U, then nobody bought the Wii U. So it doesn't really matter. But, you know, in the sense that these were disparate platforms that didn't have compatibility, I think the first thing Nintendo needs to do is make sure that there's compatibility between these platforms. And it's more of an evolution rather than a revolution, right? If you have this large install base and you're building out communities of players across, you know, online games, which they have, you don't want to disrupt those. You want to encourage them. So having backwards compatibility and making it more evolutionary is going to be key. I also think, you know, leaning into the IP is huge, right? You know, Nintendo kind of historically has only released one mainline game per major franchise per platform, right? There was, you know, and sometimes they deviate from that, right? You know, for example, Zelda, you could say that there was, well, there was Breath of the Wild and then there was the sequel, but actually Breath of the Wild was a Wii U game that got, you know, basically brought to Switch and then there was a new game. And so, you know, when you kind of actually think about it, they kind of have stuck to that strategy. And so they have kind of exhausted the list of IPs, the list of franchises for the current Switch. And so, you know, the first thing they need to do is simply lean back into their IP bank, which is enormous, obviously. Pokemon, Zelda, Metroid, all these other franchises they own, right? So number one is going to be more of the same there as well, you know, but also it's maintaining kind of the positioning in the market that was so successful for the Switch all along, which, you know, I think in the past they tried to compete directly with, you know, PlayStation and Xbox. And whereas the Switch found success was, you know, as a device that was built for the specific IPs of Nintendo, but B as a complementary console to those, as opposed to a competitive one, right? You bought it as this hybrid home and on the go device. You bought it for the specific IPs, as I said. And so I think in that sense, you know, that's really where Nintendo's going to be successful. And stepping back for a second, you know, it's not just Nintendo that's, you know, innovated in the handheld space, if we will, right? The Switch was kind of this innovative device that really brought, you know, console quality gaming to handheld. And now we've seen more devices come out. We've seen the Steam Deck. We've seen a few others. I know Logitech had one. I believe Tencent made their own handheld gaming device, right? And so as we think about kind of the landscape of handheld devices, you know, PlayStation launched their own. Xbox is rumored to be creating their own. You know, I think Nintendo, that their strong spot, and where they will differentiate and continue to be successful is by leaning into the IPs, building games that, you know, I talk about this with Roblox, right? Building games that natively take advantage of the Roblox platform that are authentic and familiar to players. That's exactly what they need to do with their next platform. And so, you know, overall, Nintendo's in a good position. They're building off really good momentum. Yes, they're going to have a down year. You know, it's fairly predicted given the state of where it's at, but I think there's a lot of excitement for the Switch 2, whatever the sequel will be. And so with that, I hope you enjoyed this episode. Stay tuned for more. As always, please make sure to rate, review, and subscribe us on all the channels where you listen. Also subscribe to our Substack because we're increasingly posting more, you know, letters and blog posts there with additional content. I'll link some of the relevant ones into the post details here, but definitely check that out to stay up to date on the latest information. Thanks so much. Have a great one.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Into the Metaverse. We hope you learned a lot and explored new aspects of the metaverse.